if I wasn't on the radio, I'd say a more colorful way, they are taxed a lot. They are taxed to a point where you've lost a lot of money compared to a percentage raise that will be happening every time you get paid after that. In other words, you go up 2% and then you start from there, you know, rather than a lump sum payment that, especially after taxes, doesn't reach that level at all. And it's a one-time thing. Let's see. A lot of the propaganda around the strike, and some of it true, I think, is this is really about the future of retooling to electric vehicles. Now, there's a lot of qualifiers on that. The last people that will really do this type of thing are these big corporations. They'll hold out as long as they can. There is a certain momentum towards electric vehicles, even on a low level. Although GM got rid of its Volt car, I believe it was GM doing the Volt. They got rid of it recently, or last year, 2 years ago or something. But anyway, there's this idea that GM wants to open an electric vehicle battery factory, and that's part of the negotiations. They quote a professor here. Labor costs that are being negotiated amount to less than 5% of the sticker price of a car. So therefore, he says that there's still room to bargain. Now, that's an interesting statistic, not for what this academic says, but because it shows you how little the workers get back for the value they create. Basic Marxist labor theory of value. You're never paid the full weight. You're never paid in wages the full value that you create. And in a car industry where these very high value, high priced cars are being churned out at a fast rate, you might make up your entire wages and benefits in a tiny portion of the year, in a couple months maybe or less, in terms of what you are really adding to the value of each vehicle because of what you do as a worker. So the workers overall, when you think about it, when you actually do the math, they could be working for free to a great extent during the year in terms of the value that's being produced. Now they get a wage, so it's like, can you say I'm working for free? I got this wage. They only pay it out incrementally. That's true. If you got your wage all at once, right, that would hurt the capitalist profits a lot. They still make profits after that time, and it would hurt them a lot. So they stretch out your wage payments. That's true of any capitalist business. But in terms of what you're actually getting versus the number of cars that you're helping to churn out, and they're doing it with a smaller workforce now, 49,000 or 59,000, whichever figure is correct. On the picket line, I love this quote. On the picket line, members have said repeatedly they want a bigger share of the more than $30 billion in profits that GM has made in the past 5 years. Yeah, okay. But GM wants to cut its labor costs so they are closer to those at U.S. factories run by foreign automakers, mainly in the South. That's an interesting sentence, isn't it? Foreign automakers, mainly in the South. That means companies that are not GM, let's say Nissan or Toyota or whatever, that have set up very cheap operations in the southern part of the United States. It's not just in Mexico or Brazil or China or wherever. It's also in the United States. That they've set up these very cheap zones of pay, and that's a whole history to that related to racism and Jim Crow South and all that kind of stuff, but also the weakness of the AFL-CIO leadership in terms of vision and a lot of other things. Anyway, that's all we're going to hear from Associated Press on that. And we're going to continue with the GM strike in a minute, but first we're going to give our official legal identification. This is WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. And just to elaborate a little bit, this is 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford, Tufts, Somerville, I'll add, Freeform Radio, and this is also known as Tufts Educational Radio. We got lots of names, and we play a lot of different types of music, and we have some talk shows. This show is talk and music. We're going to throw some music on in a minute, in a second maybe, more than a second. But you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, and we're part of that community slice of this, how do I usually say it, that WMFO community. I'm forgetting the usual thing I say. Freeform, commercial free. There it is. Community based radio and social alternative radio. A little slice of that community base. Been here a long time, and we're putting forward talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And again, as I started to say at the beginning of the show, not for just alternative information, but to get you to think about becoming a socialist. And that's not an identity thing necessarily. That is an action thing. That is a organizing progressive thing all your organizing is tied into the idea, all your activity is tied into the idea, all your opinions in a certain way that you share are tied in, not all of them, about everything, but I'm talking about politics. I see a need for fundamental change in this system, not just a more regulated capitalism, which has been tried, but socialism. We need the people to actually do the work, workers all over the world, to control what they create, what we create, and to control that democratically, to have a democratic plan of production. And by the way, if you're coming at this through the global, the environmental movement globally, which is an extremely important movement that we support, you know. But there's a big disconnect in that movement, and that is there's overlap, of course, here. But let's just get it out there. There's this consumerist approach that okay, we can have green capitalism, we can have our individual personal lifestyle changes, we'll create a decent sustainable economy, and get over climate change and other. Environmental disasters that are happening and headed our way. That's not true. You can consume yourself perfect. You can be a perfect green consumer. You can go off the grid. You can continue to think you can have green capitalism, that there's going to be corporations that are going to exist to fundamentally change the economy towards green production. And you're wrong, basically. You're wrong because if you look at where the pollution comes from, where the unsustainability comes from, it comes from the heart and soul. Well, there's no soul. It comes from there's no heart either. What do we call it? It comes from the inner workings of capitalism, basically. That short-term maximization of profit is what rules capitalism. It is not sustainability. It is not environmental protection. In fact, it is exploiting nature, exploiting the environment, and exploiting human labor to make a profit. That's what capitalism is all about. So as long as there's some sort of cheaper way of producing in a way that doesn't have to obey environmental regulations, they will find it. And that's why there's so much. One reason there's a lot of overseas production now in basic manufacturing. There's many reasons for it. But a big one that people don't often talk about, or that the corporate media doesn't often talk about, although it has been mentioned, is the lack of environmental regulation in poor countries, countries that imperialism has dominated. Or in countries like China, with a history of imperialist domination, but now the whole transition from Stalinism to state capitalism has necessitated, from their point of view, the capitalists in China and so on, and the government in China to pollute the heck out of the environment there to produce cheaper goods. That's actually changing a little bit now, but that just means the production will go over to, as it already has in many cases, Vietnam, Indonesia, other places where they will pollute the heck out of the environment and then run to the next pool of cheap labor and lack of environmental regulation to pollute the heck out of the environment in Mexico or in Brazil right now with Baldassaro, or whatever his name is. Sorry if I screwed up his name, but he's a fascist idiot. He's not a fascist, but he's right-wing. Idiot flirting with fascism, who's burning down the Amazon, whose regime is allowing the burning down of the Amazon. You know what I mean? Like, for every step backwards in the green capitalism mode of social change, there's a million steps backwards. And that's why that just doesn't work. The biggest polluters are the capitalists themselves, the big corporations that produce all the stuff, you know, with our work. You know, we can change that. We could change that tomorrow if we had democratic socialism, if we had working people in control of the economy, and we created a international democratic plan of production, not for profit, short-term maximization profit, but for human needs. And that would include, and human needs has to be survivability of the species, right? With a sustainable environment, with sustainable production for an environment that is not going to be eventually uninhabitable for human life. So it's extremely important that the big corporations, obviously, to go back a second, to be taken over and controlled publicly, by society, by working people, and figuring out democratically the best way to produce what we really need and really want. Not just, I'm talking about austerity. I'm talking about what we, I'm talking about actually more abundance, but in a sustainable way, in a way that doesn't harm the environment, and or doesn't harm it nearly as much. Let's put it that way. And that is doable, but only with fundamental social change, not through consumerism, consumerist solutions. While you're going green with your bike ride, Donald Trump is riding in a limousine and Air Force One. Let's just put it that way. Okay, so I mean, the big corporations and actually the military pollute. And this is, you can find these statistics pretty easily. You know, the 70, 80, 90% of the pollution comes from those sources. There was this film called The Corporation that came out in the 90s. And that film was all about what corporations are. And it had a lot of flaws in it. But one of the things it did was it tracked this company that wanted to become a green company. Just, you know, as much sustainable production as possible, et cetera. And they made rugs. Right, and the guy had a social. The owner had a social conscience. Now, it was a relatively small company, big enough to pay attention to, but relatively small, and regarding like compared to like GM or something or other companies, big corporations. You never heard of it if you watch the movie. You probably never heard of the corporation that they ended up focusing on for this aspect. And by the end of the film, through this torturous, we can reform capitalism mindset that the filmmakers had. And that the owner of this corporation had, they were trumpeting a 30% green rating, 30% sustainability of all their production. 30% of it was sort of it being done in a green way, as they defined it, which is probably not the greatest definition, but they were at least honest to say, yeah, we only reached 30%, although they thought that was wonderful. That's not wonderful. That's not nearly enough. And it took a long time to get there. And no, sorry, that's not the way it's going to happen. If we're going to survive, it's not the way it's going to happen. And the whole history of capitalism shows that. And what's happening now shows that. And anyway, we'll come back to the environmental crisis in future shows. But I want to go back to the GM strikers in a minute. But first, we're going to take a break, have some music. Stay with us. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on WMFO 91.5 FM.
Standing on the corner, spending my time, not of a job, not earning a dime. Lady steps up, says, I suppose you're a stylish young man by the looks of your clothes. Said, trust me and take a little tip. This building's been sold to Johnny Depp. Who? Take the bow, relocate. The Google men are coming downtown, so don't be late. This is my apartment, just a hole in the wall. Got to sleep in the kitchen with your feet in the hall. No hot water, no windows and doors. You gotta make it past all the real estate agents, junkies and hoes. Heart of the city, ain't no coffee shops around. I heard them Google men drink so much coffee, I declare, I think they might drown. Gentrification is here. Oh, one thing I know, you can't stand pat.
I declare you got to step it up and go.
is here. Sure is where my mind can't understand why uptown Google man wants a downtown like mine.
Gentrification.
Ry Cooder from a, I think it's a new album. 2018, relatively new, called Prodigal Son. We've been featuring on the show last couple shows. I love it. He is someone I listened to way, way back in the 80s, and he's still around putting out some great music. And this album is called The Prodigal Son by Ry Cooder. And that song was called Gentrification. And maybe we'll hear more from him later in the show. Right now, it's back to the GM workers and the auto workers and the United Auto Workers that are on strike and related matters. But before that, we'll do a couple of public service announcements because that's the kind of radio station we are. And again, you're listening to WMFO 90.5 FM. If you just turned in, find us at WMFO.org. Or if you're lucky enough to be in Medford or Somerville, or parts of Medford and Somerville, parts of other parts of Greater Boston, just go online, you know? I mean, not online, I'm sorry. Go live on the air and see where the wind takes us and at WMFO 91.5 FM. So a public service announcement, numbers to think about. Some numbers to think about. The United States has less than 5% of the planet's population, but incarcerates, that means puts in prisons of various sorts, 24% of the world's prisoners, and accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. That's depressing. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Now, I want to talk about the last part there, because we usually, when I read that PSA, and I do read it a lot, I'm talking about the incarceration part, which is horrific. I'm going to talk about the military part for a second. There's some people that, you know, a lot of people out there that want military spending cut. Corporate media doesn't focus on that, obviously. So, but people have persevered, and they've done some really good research. And I saw this graph one time where you could take U.S. military spending and add up the next 14 countries. This includes China, Russia, whoever. And all their military spending combined does not equal the U.S.'s military spending. Okay? Double check that. But that's what I remember. You could take U.S. military bases around the world. Some are secret. They're not included. It's about 250, I think, or 150, 250. And you can see them kind of encircle, like they sort of cluster. Again, I'm talking about a graphic here. So here on radio, I'm like giving you a picture with words. You see this cluster of them circling, encircling a certain area of the world. Where do you think that is? Is it Russia? No. It is the Middle East. It's the oil. It's the oil. You know, and I remember like in a lot of anti-war demos I've been to, people were like at a certain point, you can't just say it's about the oil. No, it's not just about the oil, but it's a lot about the oil. And why would that be, do you think? Well, because oil goes into the production of plastics, it goes into production of energy, obviously gasoline and so on. Yeah, it's about the oil. It's not just about like, you know, morally bad people. If you're going to talk about morally bad capitalists, you're going to talk about anyone that becomes a capitalist and survives. I mean, at it for any modicum of time. There's no moral to it. It's a machine. It's an economic system. Here's one I like because why not feed into our paranoia? Now, you know, as far as like politics goes, left wing politics. And if you're someone new to like left wing, I've actually run into people like this. Well, you know, I'd get involved, but I don't want to be spied on by the FBI or the CIA or whoever, the local cops, whoever does the spying on political movements and groups and so on. I'm like, yeah, you know, that's happened. Sure, look at the Black Panthers and COINTELPRO and so on. It's been really horrible. Shows we don't really live in a free country like everybody says. However, you can't let it stop you from organizing. There's too many of us, really. They can't throw us all in jail. They really can't. They can certainly scare a lot of us. And here's something that might scare you a little bit. Why not cover your computer camera? If you have a computer with a webcam and you don't use it, why not cover the camera up with a piece of opaque tape? Opaque means you can't see through it. Like black tape. In addition to government programs, there's plenty of other malware and viruses that can hijack the computer's camera to spy on you. So if you don't use it, consider covering it up. A message in the public interest from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. So there's a couple of public service announcements for our listening audience to think about. And as with anything we say here at Tufts Educational Radio, which I like that name, think about it. Please think about it. And think about this, the GM strikers. Now, this is a different source I'm going to be quoting from and discussing. This is from Jane Slaughter, longtime union activist and analyst, writer with Labor Notes. And this is also from the same day, that last article, October 2nd. In week three of the strike, GM strikers hold firm for making temps permanent, temporary workers. And she's, just to quote Jane Slaughter here, General Motors workers have been on the picket line for 17 days now and just picked up their first weekly strike pay of $250. Not enough, obviously, but something. Strikers wonder who will hold out the longest, a workforce seeking justice or an immensely profitable corporation demanding more concessions. GM's huge profits, $35 billion in the last 3 years, are both a spur to the strikers who know GM can afford to pay and a source of strength for the company, which has a well-padded cushion. Strikers, some of whom make as little as $15.78 an hour, have less of a fallback. With strikes a rarity at the big three automakers recently, workers may not have expected their leaders to call one this year, so they might not have saved up enough money. You can never save up enough, but anyway. GM turned out, quoting again Jane Slaughter in Labor Notes, GM turned out to be playing harder ball than the UAW pro-cooperation leaders were expecting, and thus the strike. There's a whole generation of labor leaders, I suffer under this, at Harvard, who are believe in partnership with management, cooperation with management, all those nice-sounding words that mean we're business unionists, and we will do anything to establish a relationship with a company to keep the dues money coming in, but screw you. If there's a real problem, we're not going to fight. We're not going to fight for you. We're not going to fight for the union as a whole. We're going to continue. We'll give concessions as long as we can avoid any sort of unpleasantness. And ignoring the class character, class nature of capitalism, of the system, ignoring how businesses work. You know, it's funny to be called a business unionist when you don't understand anything about business, but that's what it comes down to. Business unionists understand nothing about business. Or they don't care because, you know, they're in it for the short term. They're in it for some salaries that will they'll retire on or whatever. Anyway, this is a good article because, by the way, go to labornotes.org, find this article. It has all 19 GM facilities, factories where they're on strike. They encourage people to go show their solidarity. That's really good. So her information is similar to other articles in some senses, but she puts it a little differently. For example, the company has reportedly floated raising workers' health insurance costs. That wasn't mentioned in the other article. Creating a new lower paid tier of workers to build batteries as well. Paying bonuses in alternate years instead of wage increases. And keeping the wage boost to 4% over four years with a 1% raise, which is horrible. This is besides GM's ambition to staff the factories with even more temporary workers than they do now. The company admits to 7% of the hourly workforce being temps. It also has thousands of contractors with no job security in the salaried ranks of GM. German, Japanese, and Korean-owned factories in the U.S. with no union contracts already rely heavily on perma-temps, meaning temp workers hired for an indefinite amount of time. And, of course, GM sees no reason to give back any of the myriad concessions the union made in 2007 to 2015. Half pay and no pensions for new hires, for example, plus other new tier systems of total of at least 8, an end to cost of living adjustments, no daily overtime pay after 8 hours. These are things that have already been given into by the union leadership. Only after 40 hours per week, as required by law, would overtime kick in. It used to kick in after 8 hours per day. And elimination of the Supplemental Unemployment Benefits Fund, designed for the layoffs that are cyclical to the auto industry, what to look out for. Jane Slaughter again. What should GM workers and their Ford Chrysler counterparts be looking out for when a tentative agreement is finally reached? UAW leaders have said next to nothing about concrete demands before the strike began. They have been almost tight-lipped since. Official communications call for fair wages, quote-unquote, fair wages, job security, our share of profits, affordable quality health care, and defined path to permanent seniority for temps. Four of these are vague, leaving negotiators plenty of wiggle room. What's a fair wage? When is health care affordable? The exception is the language on temps. A cynic would worry that members are being warned in advance temps will not be made whole anytime soon. Nor is there any mention of shortening the eight-year path from second tier to first, or making the actual plant workers equal to assembly plant workers, or getting rid of super low-paid GM subsystems workers who handle parts inside assembly plants. A category created ostensibly to help build electrical vehicles more cheaply. They work for a GM subsidiary, but are under a separate bare-bones UAW contract. Jane Slaughter, by the way, used to work in the auto industry, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, there's a lot more information about that. The thing I mentioned earlier, the UAW has floated the idea, this is according to Jane Slaughter again, floating the idea that it would keep workers on strike while they vote on a tentative agreement. That's not the usual practice lately. UAW bargainers will likely try to thread the needle between GM's demands and the rank and files. They don't want a repeat of 2015 when Chrysler workers voted down by a 2-to-1 margin, a contract that had no path to regular wages for the second tier workers at all. Bargainers were forced to return to the table where they negotiated the 8-year path, but also allowed a greater use of temps. So there's this tension between the workers that are tending to be more progressive in what they want in terms of their demands, and the unionership still wanting to do the old concession business unionist 1990s thing, 1980, 1990s thing. So that's a pretty good article. Check out socialalternative.org also for an article on the strike. And what really needs to happen here is spreading the strike beyond GM. It's a good opportunity to do that. Go in using the momentum from spreading the strike to organize the plants in the South with strikes to go out in terms of recognition. This is what happened in the 30s. And then also to a great extent in the auto industry. And also any time that the company tries to shut down a plant, basically the union should be fighting for that factory to be taken under public ownership, because we need electric cars, we need high-speed rail, we need more mass transit in general, we need battery plants, which batteries that could go to all sorts of energy and transportation needs. The work is there, the work is needed. It shouldn't be left to the short-term maximization of profit god that the corporations worship. It's what we need as a society, not just for jobs and wages and at union rates and so on. That's part of this, obviously, an important part. I mean, let me try to make it concrete for you. If you think, a lot of people, like, I don't know, even working people sometimes, they're like, they don't see concretely what a union does for somebody. But if your pay goes up, and on average, union wages are much higher than non-union wages, if you don't see your pay going up, then a whole range of, on a decent basis, and your benefits go down, which is going to cost you more money for things like healthcare and so on, if you even get healthcare in a non-union situation, that can make the difference between a lot of life-changing things, let's say, under capitalism. So using my own life as an example again, as I was earlier, my parents didn't know how they were going to send me to college. I had a brother that had attended college, and that was taking up resources. That took up resources. By the time I was going to go, I also had a couple of siblings that didn't go. But where are you going to come up with the money for college? This is back in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Where the money's going to come from college was still a concern, even though it was cheaper then, right? And we had no answer to that in my family. Where's the money come from me to go to college? Just there was no answer. We didn't have enough money. The fact that I was able to get a job in a union factory that produced, you know, baked goods, basically a general food factory, then that made it that made me able to get a wage and benefits that were good, but a wage especially because I was really young and didn't need the benefits as much yet, to save enough money through overtime and stuff. It wasn't easy, but you know, because of the union base rate of pay, even as a newly hired person, even after paying a union initiation fee, which I gladly paid because I was already pro-union, I was able to save enough money to not only go to college, but reverse some of the things that I had set in motion that I thought I had to do. Like, I was already signed up for ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Corps, to go through college through 4 years of ROTC, and then 5 years in the military. No negotiation there. Once you go through ROTC, once you're in it after the first year, they got you then for 5 years after you graduate. Now, that first year, though, you can opt out, and I did, because I realized I was making enough money through the union job that I didn't have to go into the Army as a junior officer, supposedly, telling people to do really bad things in other countries, which at my time would have been the invasion of Panama, stuff going on covertly in various places, and what was the other one? Grenada, you know, stuff like that. U.S. imperialism trying to find its feet again after its defeat in Vietnam, but unfortunately finding its feet again. And so I was able to alter my life drastically, to put it simply, by not having to be in the Army, be able to, you know, afford school with some other help, obviously, from my parents and from scholarships and all that kind of stuff, and working. So I worked that job, you know, over the course of my entire college years, and that allowed me to pay for a lot of stuff related to school, and that's what a union can do for you. A union can give you enough money to do something big, you know, to survive something big, to get a house, you know, etc. And it's no accident, even the corporate media will admit this, that the decline in the power of unions in this country has meant a severe decline in wage rates in this country. And there's just a direct correlation between that. Now, I don't mean to imply the way they might or the way some professors might, that everything was great back in the day when unions had, believe it or not, the highest rate of unionization in this country was only 34 or 35% of the workforce. And that started to decline back in 1953. But at a slow rate at first, but it was declining. And I remember growing up during the tail end of the post-war upswing, and there were still people, obviously there was still poverty, people suffering and so on. So it never got to the point where unionization alone solved the problems of capitalism. That's not what I'm talking about. But it ameliorated them for millions of working people. And as a socialist, you know, I'm for anything that will help working people, but I do it eyes wide open. You know, if we get a reform on healthcare, like even if we were in a country, even if we were in Britain, right, and we got the National Health Service after World War II because a labor government got in and they have a labor party, we don't even have that, etc. I would be like, yeah, we have a National Health Service, but it's not going to last forever. And it still exists. Here it is, many years later. It still exists in Britain. But guess what? Over the years, including now, the corporations are always trying to starve it of funds. And that has created a crisis in the National Health Service. It's created a lower level of care than they used to have. And it's created more and more talk of privatization and parallel systems where the rich get other types of care. They don't have to be use the NHS system, et cetera, et cetera. So any reform under capitalism is temporary. It doesn't solve the problem. That's the real problem, the real root of the problem and the problem itself. One last thing on GM here. This is from Business Insider, but it's an opinion piece by someone named Mike Elk, whose name rings a bell. I didn't bother to look him up, but I think he's been an activist on the left in unions and so on. And I like this article because, as you'll see from the title, the massive GM strike is energizing a new push among auto workers in the South that could shake up the industry. And, quote, the tide is changing. You can feel it, says union activist and sheet metal worker Adrian Mizell, as cars pass by honking their horns in support of workers here out on strike at the local General Motors facility. Now, where is this? Well, this is in the South, Spring Hill, Tennessee. He said, there's been so much honking, and you can just tell that thousands and thousands of the community feel the same, that feel the same as the people here standing up for this. This is vocal support. And another horn burst as they're talking. These are people that feel strongly, and you can't raise that kind of attention unless you stand up in solidarity for people's rights. Quote, for decades, the United Auto Workers has struggled to unionize foreign auto plants in the South, but union activists at plants scattered across the region say the high-profile GM strike has created a new momentum for unions here. The strike could ignite union organizing that could help improve working conditions for tens of thousands of auto workers throughout the South, where auto plants have moved in recent years to avoid UAW bastions of strength in the Rust Belt. And then here's a subhead. The GM strike is inspiring new hope at auto plants in the South. Now, there was they're going to talk about this, so I won't mention that. But I was just going to say, what's this all about, basically, is that whether you're brand new to finding out about the labor movement and unions, or whether you are old enough to remember Norma Rae, that movie Norma Rae and the unions in the South in the 70s and the big fights there to organize the textile industry, which is largely gone now, and so on in the South. The South has been a region of the United States with more poverty, region of the United States with more, less unionization, and again, direct correlation there between the two. But it wasn't an accident. The Jim Crow Democrats really fought hard to keep the South non-union, and there was a point where the AFL-CIO leadership I think it was Truman or one of the presidents at the end of the 40s into the 50s, I think it might have been Truman, but it might have been right after that, they basically kind of struck a deal that the Republicans would fight less on the question of health insurance regulation and health insurance being tied to workplaces. So a lot of people were getting health insurance through their workplaces, and it was regulated a certain way to be a lower cost than it is now, for example. And not everyone got it, but it was becoming widespread, like Blue Cross and Blue Shield and so on. And in exchange for that kind of supposed deal, they pulled back from a thing called Operation Dixie, where the AFL-CIO was going to do a massive organizing drive at a time where they had massive momentum, late 40s, from the struggles in the 30s and into the 40s. Massive momentum, massive resources. They could have gone and organized the South quickly, efficiently, in a lot of places, a lot of cities, and they could have had a... increased... exponentially increase the power of the civil rights movement, because some of the early civil rights movement people and people that were mainstays of the rights movement came from the labor movement and used and unions helped the civil rights movement a lot. And if that had been happening right down in the South earlier on than the 50s and into the 60s, which a union drive would have sparked, I'll tell you anything, it would have sparked that, because the bosses, the big corporations, would have gone after the workers like crazy, and the workers would have fought back. And there's a tendency towards unity when you're under attack, and it would have been tough, given the racism and so on in the South, but it would actually have happened. There were examples of it, small examples of it, in the 40s even, and in the 30s. Big examples in the 30s, actually, of there's a famous example or infamous example of Ford, again, remember Henry Ford mentioned during the show, bringing in intentionally anti-union black preachers from the South, from the Deep South, setting them up in their own churches and nice digs in the North around auto plants, and having them preach against the union, and then going down and recruiting as many Southern black people that Ford could manage to recruit to work in the factories as a divide and conquer thing, thinking the white workers and the black workers just fight each other all the time, due to racism and so on, and the black preachers will keep the black workers de-radicalized and won't be interested in the union. And boom, it didn't work. Conditions were too harsh, became too harsh during the Depression. The workers knew, both white and black workers knew that they figured out who their real enemy was. The Communist Party was organizing seriously among the workers. The labor movement was organizing, the CIO, birth of the CIO. There's just everything conspired against Ford's plan in a good way. And there was unity, workers' unity. I mean, I have this picture I'll never forget of the strike victory of one of the big plant occupations, and the workers running out of the factory with complete joy on their faces were both black and white. And it was just an amazing picture. You see what a victory can do, especially after a struggle. I just listened to this whole thing by Sebastian Unger on National Propaganda Radio yesterday, about how he wrote a book about war and about how troops in war establish these bonds that ironically are some of the deepest human solidarity bonds that he thought existed on the planet. And therefore, and this is what humans are wired for, he said, that they goes back to the tribal societies, hunter-gatherer societies, etc., where small groups of 30 or 40 people or whatever would live together. Don't quote me on the numbers, but that's what something he said. I'm not buying into totally his argument. It's a little reductionist, but whatever. But I'm going to use an analogy in a second. But basically, he said, so, you know, this battalion that he embedded with fit that profile, and people would sacrifice for each other, and that kind of bonds of solidarity, and also the charge of combat that kind of reinforced that, which is not like not in a sick way, but in a way like, you know, just everything is so important what you're doing. I mean, in terms of surviving, that it created these bonds that are just huge, and most people don't get to live that way. So that's how people would look back at time in the army that was both horrible and yet, wow, I never experienced this kind of, someone would sacrifice their life for me in a second. And we were so tight and so close and everything. And well, Sebastian Unger, that's a rough analogy. There's some things wrong with it, but we'll leave that aside for now. But say, hey, there are other struggles, and I can tell you, union struggles, if they're in a certain importance and a certain level of importance, a certain level of intensity, that same solidarity and empathy comes through, and people realize that they're not meant to beat each other's throats. They realize who the real enemy is in society, and you'll never forget that. And you learn a lot, like I said earlier, and that's putting it mildly, you learn a lot, not just intellectually, but emotionally, that carries you over. And you know, people are, socialists are born in struggles like that. You know, this is something that will impact you, and you'll try to figure out more why it happened and what happened, and it'll turn you into a lifelong socialist, basically, in a lot of cases. And so in the 30s and 40s, when that was happening, the labor movement in a big way, but even at other times, even more recent times, there's a lot of people are sort of, let's just say, educated and radicalized out of those struggles. That could be happening now in some of these struggles, obviously. And this is one thing, reason I like this article, is just saying this is going to have an effect that the other analyses of the article of the strike are not really focusing on. This is going to have an effect in terms of the mood towards unions. It's already a high percentage, I think it's even up to 60% or something, favorability rating towards unions now in this country. But this could actually be concrete evidence that yes, you can go on strike and you can win some gains and et cetera, like has already happened with the West Virginia teachers and the Stop and Shop strike and others. This will continue, and this is happening in the South in a lot of these places. But he gets into this thing about inspiring hope. We'll have to finish on this point. I have to hurry up now because of the time. He said, Mike Elk. The strike of over 49,000 GM workers entering its second week is the longest strike that UAW has had since 1970, when workers went on strike for 67 days. Workers now are angry over the outsourcing of American jobs, the heavy usage of temporary workers by GM, and GM's demand that workers pay more for health care, despite GM making $11.8 billion in profit in 2018 alone. In June, workers at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, just 2 hours down the road from GM's Spring Hill facility in Tennessee, the one we were just talking about, lost a union vote by a margin of 29 votes. Now union activists in the plant say that workers who voted against the union are becoming more union-friendly as they watch the support GM strikers receive. Seeing the UAW workers fight back against GM, it opens their eyes a little bit because they don't realize the power you have as labor if you withhold labor, says Bill Quigg, a union leader at the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, who had fought for 8 years to persuade his fellow workers to vote for the union. Quigg says the strike is leading a lot of union ambivalent workers to ask questions about strikes and what unions can do there. Now, this is going to happen at other places. Then the article goes into a long history of union suppression at Southern auto plants, which there is. For example, to defeat the union drive, Volkswagen management repeatedly warned the plant might close if a union was voted in, citing Volkswagen's decision to close a Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania plant in 1988 after a series of strikes organized by the UAW workers there, etc. So, what do you do? What do you do under capitalism at any time? Even back before so-called globalization, a company could still decide to close down and move its production. It was harder to do maybe at certain points of time in certain places, and it still is harder to do at certain points of time in certain places. Does that mean that you can't go on strike, that you can't fight for public ownership of a plant that threatens to leave, or a workplace that threatens to shut down? Of course you can. Of course you can. You still have to, in fact. And the point of the labor movement and socialism being international is to spread that militancy, spread that willingness to go on strike and fight and organize on an international basis. So there's nowhere for capitalism to run and hide in terms of a pool of beaten down, repressed, suppressed, cheap labor because of poverty and everything else that capitalism has engendered there. And then... And use that and use the lack of environmental regulations and so on, like we talked about earlier, to create cheap goods and then ship them back to the so-called advanced capitalist countries. Now, that doesn't always work out. Sometimes companies can't afford that to be far away. The production can't afford to be far away from the consumption. So it's not a... Every company that threatens to move, in other words, can't really follow through on the threat. Those that can have to be stopped. And there are various ways to stop that. One other way would be to have a real workers' party in power, not the Democrats, not the Republicans, but a real anti-corporate political party. They would just say, no, it's against the law. You can't shut down that. And if you shut down, the government's going to take it over. And the people are going to run it that do the work and the people that depend on that work and that product even. So the rest of the article is really good, just don't really have time to get into it. The sort of intellectual, emotional effect that a strike movement can do in a very important industry, but even beyond. And that was shown again in those numbers I cited earlier, that since the more strikes in 2018 than at any time since 1986, and here it's happening down south in the auto industry and other places related. Some things we didn't get to today I really wanted to really get to, and we'll have to try next time, but I want to give you some headlines here and then fade away for the day. We've talked a lot on the show about the GI Bill and redlining and how... What are the capitalist sort of institutional structures that were deliberately set up and still exist, really, in a lot of ways, to keep to keep black working people in dire straits, basically, relatively speaking, poverty to a greater percentage than among any other racial category of workers, if you want to put it that way. I'm always looking for like more information on that. And there was a really good article I came across from Aaron Blakemore from September 30th, 2019, how the GI Bill's promise was denied a million black World War II veterans. That's not new information, but it's most of it. But it's good. It's good. It's condensed really well. We'll come back to that in another show, but I just wanted to say that if you've heard us talk about the redlining and that book that came out, The Color of Law, that we recommended activists and everyone read, basically, that this goes into that more, the redlining of the banks and so on, but also the educational aspect of the GI Bill, how that was denied to a lot of people, a lot of black people in particular as well. Also, we had an article I was really going to enjoy talking about, the case for a four-day work week. We'll have to come back to that one. This is from Vox. Self-explanatory, but gives some good stats and so on. And then you might have been seeing in the corporate media recently some new statistics on wealth inequality in the U.S. The U.S. wealth gap just hit a depressing 50-year high is one example. We can get into that next time. And follow-up to that from inequality.org, a website I suggest you check out, inequality.org. We, that's a little problematic there to say we, but whatever, waited too long for corporations to fix the CEO pay problem on their own, and give you some of the latest statistics on the gap between workers' pay and CEO pay. And finally, one near and dear to my heart, an issue, a problem that used to get a lot of attention and that has fallen off the radar. So, let's get into working class feminism versus glass ceiling bourgeois feminism sometime, because this is something that everyone should be talking about, especially feminists, especially socialists who are by nature feminists, I would argue. But anyway, 33% of parents went into debt to pay for summer childcare in 2018. 33%. I'm part of that percentage. Yay. And really good up-to-date statistics on childcare, the crisis of childcare, the cost of childcare in this country. And, that just got lost somehow in the shuffle from the late 70s, early 80s until now. Starting to come up a little bit now, but it should be a huge, huge issue. And I predict it will be, because it's unsustainable the way it's going. So we're gonna get out early today. We always promise that to the next show, that we're not going to wait till the last second. And this time I mean it, darn it. And so you've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check us out on the archive function at WMFO.org. You'll get one of our shows at least in there, hopefully. And we're going to go out with something I haven't listened to, so I'm not going to, can't guarantee this, but it looked good. It's called Resonance. Christopher Ease, I don't know who that is. And there's a subheading I can't read. Oh, yeah, John Doe Saves the World. We're going to go out with that music. And thanks for listening. Spread the word about the show. We're on Facebook, of course. Socialist Alternative Radio. We put a lot of new content, share a lot of content on that Facebook page. And most importantly, though, as we started to say earlier, don't just gather up all this good information and learn all the good stuff to read about that's inspired or direct result of, Marxist or socialist methodology and so on, but actually get involved. And there's a lot to get involved in. There is a socialist movement in this country, however underground or under the radar it may seem, and you have a place in it if you want it, and you're a key factor in changing the world, and it's happening all over the world, believe it or not. When you look at something like the demonstrations in Hong Kong, for example, did you know there's socialists involved in that? There are. There's many socialists involved in that demonstration, those demonstrations happening in Hong Kong. When you look at the strike that we just talked about, do you think there's socialist auto workers? There are socialist auto workers. I'm not claiming they're the majority or anything at this point in time, but they're there. And that provides a kind of each person that is that kind of conscious working class socialist individual or someone helping out, whether they're working class or not, it doesn't really matter. I mean, there's a lot to do. That has a ripple effect beyond, an influence beyond that one individual that I find has been extremely powerful. My experience in the labor movement is that every really well-meaning good union activist is welcome, of course, but their power is very, very limited if they can't connect the dots, if they don't understand the nature of the system, if they don't have a vision for the future that's alternative to capitalism. When they have that, it puts a fire in their belly, it puts knowledge in their head that can't be bought off, and it's just enormous power that if more of us had that power, this secret superpower, I'm just kidding, if more of us were able to, it's not a secret thing at all, anyone can have it, then things will change. They definitely will change. So thanks for listening, and we'll go out with this new music.
Sociopathic sycophants, radicalized by radio rants. These days we know a lot more, more about everything than ever before. If knowledge were progress, it's fair to ask, how come we agree less and less? Divided we stand, poor against poor, shamelessly rolled by political whores, sacrificial supplicants, praying for lives we'll never get back. Forget the rules, they're insane. This time, it's not the same. The clock is ticking faster each day. This time it's not the same. Oh, this time it's not the same. Split at the seam, forcing all sides to either extreme. Autonomic adjutants